Welcome to Gay Mystery Podcast, featuring interviews with renowned LGBTQ authors and up-and-coming talent of mystery, suspense, and thriller novels. I'm your host, Brad Shreve, and Justine Adamick is here with her weekly recommendation. My guest today is Greg Herron, but before we get to Greg, as always, we have Justine to give us her book recommendation this week. What you got, Justine?
I have got Murder at Queen Street, The Piccadilly Detectives by James Woodall. Murder at Queen Street is the title and is the first book in a series called The Piccadilly Detectives. And there's a second book, which is The Deep End. And there's a promise of a third book, although it looks like it's been delayed. But they're on the webpage for this series, there is a third book planned. Well, this is set in London in the Roaring 20s. The second book is set in the Roaring 30s. But this one is set in the Roaring 20s. What I like most about this book is that every now and then he drops a footnote in. And footnotes in fiction sounds a little weird, but you can read them all at the end. And what he does is he gives you a lot of context for what's going on in the 1920s in London. He did a lot of historical research, and he also refers you on to other websites and other books to understand the time more, the time better. The detectives are Hugo and Theo. They're a couple. Theodore is actually. So Hugo and Theodore, they're a couple, and they are sharing a flat, a two-bedroom flat, but they have one room set aside for working, and there's papers on the bed, and they both share the bed in the larger room. They run a detective agency, and in that detective agency, they only serve, well, their goal, because you'll find out in this one, they make an exception. And what he does, their business cards, the quote from Oscar Wilde's The Ballad of Reading Jail, "For each man kills the things he loves." That's not really something that would let everybody know that they cater to queer folk, but queer folk then knew this. This was from the Oscar Wilde play and the Oscar Wilde poem, and they understood it as a code for queer folk were welcome here. So they have this rooming house, upper flat in the rooming house, and their landlady is at the beginning unaware that they are homosexual. And the maid comes down, the housekeeper comes down and says, they're sleeping in one bed. And the landlady is, you know, flabbergasted. How could such a thing happen? After all, they're gentlemen. She fires the housekeeper, and then she thinks about it and goes upstairs and confronts them, hoping for a denial. And they say, well, yes, of course. To her credit, she says, well, I'm not going to report you to the police. And then not to her credit, she says, I want you to leave. And then to her credit, she says, but you have 4 weeks. All in all, they accept this as a fair compromise, and they resign themselves to leaving. They start leaving the check in the mailbox instead of meeting her. And then after about a week and a half, somebody's murdered in one of their other flats in the building, and now all of a sudden the landlady needs their help. That's where they get the exception to their usual clientele of queer folk.
Ah.
So they solve the mystery. It's a bit of a cozy mystery because it's a locked room. Only people that were in the building at the time of the murder. But then there's another story in which the landlady comes to terms with, you know, their relationship, doesn't really approve. There's a part in the footnotes where he said in the first draft, she really just came around and accepted them fully. And he decided that was not realistic. So she's fine with them staying at that. And then, you know, I'm sure they would never speak of it again. Hugo and Theodore are a wonderful couple. They're very devoted to each other. And Theodore quotes from Shakespeare and William Blake and Dylan Thomas. So there are a lot of very well-educated and very much the gentlemen that their landlady considers themselves to be.
Well, I'm concerned. Did she hire back the housekeeper?
No.
Oh, okay. Anyway, that has nothing to do with the story. I'm concerned.
Well, you know. Well, I hate to disappoint you, and I'm sorry if that's a spoiler.
No, that won't run the story for me.
That's all right. The second book, there's a body found in a bathhouse. I don't know if that sounds familiar to you at all.
Just a little.
However, it is set in 1930s London, when bathhouses were a little more genteel.
Just a touch, though.
And catered to gentlemen. I'm sure they were gentlemen in your book.
Yes.
They probably didn't wear top hats and carry canes.
No. And I doubt they did back then either.
You don't think so? I mean, the picture on the cover has silhouettes of men in top hats and canes.
In the bathhouse? What, do they have a top hat and a cane and a towel around their waist?
Well, no, but you'd walk in with the top hat and cane and then leave it in whatever, you know, locker type thing they have.
Well, there. Yes, of course you can.
That's right. So if you like this book, you don't actually have to buy it, because on his website, PiccadillyDetectives.com, both books are available for completely for free. Feel free to go and enjoy them.
And I'll put that on the website on the show notes to make it easy.
And we will add this book and the Greg Herron book to our wonderful database that was put together by us from Graham Cheater. And if you haven't used it, I think all our listeners should take a look and see how many books we've actually gone through in the last year.
Yep. Just go to GameMysteryPodcast.com and there's a link at the top.
Okay.
I'm running you off the rails today. Do you have anything about Recruit Tales?
Today we release the fifth in the Grant Michaels, Dan Krachik series, Time to Check Out. Buy it, borrow it on Kindle Unlimited. The earlier you do that, the higher it places on the bestseller lists, and other people get to see it.
So if you want it and you want to help promote Recruit Tales, which you should, pre-order it.
That's right. Okay,
that's it for this week,
Brad.
So we're on to Greg Herron.
All right. See you later, Brad, next week.
If you enjoy Gay Mystery Podcast, let others know by leaving a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to our show. Greg Herron is an American writer and editor who publishes work in a variety of genres, including mystery novels, young adult, literature, and erotica. He publishes work both as Greg Herron and under the pseudonym Todd Gregory. His novel Murder in the Rue Chartres, I'm going to ask him if I got that wrong, I'm sure I did, won a Lambda Literary Award in the Gay Mystery category at the 2008 Lambda Literary Awards. And his anthology Love, Bourbon Street, Reflections of New Orleans, co-edited with Paul J. Willis, won in the anthologies category on the 2007 Lambda Literary Awards. He is currently Executive Vice President of Mystery Writers of America. And Greg, how bad did I do on that book name?
It's Charters, is how you say it.
Charters, okay. So I made it more difficult than it was.
It actually, well, in France is Chartres, and of course in New Orleans we say everything wrong, so it's Charters here. But so yeah, you didn't do as bad as you. I've heard worse.
Okay, that's good. Thank you. And you were on the show before as a special panel discussion that I had, but this is the first time that I've had a one-on-one chat with you. So welcome.
Well, thank you for having me.
Now, I'd like to start with your position as Executive Vice President of the Mystery Writers of America.
Okay.
Are you the first LGBTQ person who has held an office that high in the organization?
I'm going to go out on a limb and say yes. I can't swear to it, but I will say that I'm the first openly gay man who writes openly gay mystery novels. Or mystery novels about openly gay characters that has held this office before. The organization was, and this is not to be critical, but I believe we've only had two or three women in the role, so it's been primarily mostly straight white men for the majority of the history of the organization, which is in its 75th year. So, yeah, I think I am the first. There might have been somebody who was not open, but I'm the first openly gay executive vice president.
Congratulations on that. I know this has been a challenging year for you with that, but when did you join Mr. Writers of America, and what has been your involvement with them over the years?
I first joined MWA, I believe it was sometime between 2005 and 2010. I don't know exactly that correct year. I want to say 2007 or 2008. Unfortunately, the years after 2005 with Hurricane Katrina are kind of blurry.
Yeah.
So I can't really pinpoint an exact date. I had always been told by my straight mystery writer friends that I should join MWA because it's the oldest organization of its kind, and it's beneficial to mystery writers to belong to it. But as a gay mystery writer, I wasn't really comfortable in heterosexual mystery spaces.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until around 2006, 2007, 2008 that I started to feel a little more comfortable joining the mainstream mystery organizations. I do know I joined Sisters in Crime in 2010, if I'm not mistaken. Whenever the BioShakan Mystery Conference was in San Francisco, that was when I joined, and Ellen Hart was the one who got me to join Sisters in Crime. But I already belonged to MWA at that point. And then shortly after that, I believe in 2011, I joined my local chapter board. And from there, I went on, became president of my local chapter, which got me onto the national board for MWA for 4 years. And I've been off the board for quite a while now. And they asked me if I would come back and be the executive vice president, serve as executive vice president. And I said yes, and I weakly doubt the wisdom of that ever since. But it's been a challenging year. But it's been a challenging year for the organization, but it's a challenging year for everyone's having a challenging year. So yeah. It was going to be an interesting year. Being executive vice president was going to be an interesting experience the first year anyway, because learning how the organization runs and learning what all the individual committees do and what the chapters do and having to make decisions for the organization really was going to be a challenge to begin with, because there was a lot that I didn't know. And so coming into it and learning on the job in the middle of a pandemic has been challenging, but at the same time, it's also been kind of, everyone's being very generous about my job performance, in that it's been an unprecedented year that anyone would have difficulty navigating through. So everyone's being very, very kind and generous. It's been a very pleasant, for the most part, it's been a very pleasant experience. It's just a lot of work, and staying on top of it is kind of challenging, but not quite as type A as I thought I was.
I got to tell you, looking at your bio and your background, I find your background absolutely fascinating. You've done a lot. But there's a particular story that I'm very interested in.
Oh, dear.
As I understand it, you were scheduled to speak to the Gay Straight Alliance at a high school in Midlothian, Virginia.
Oh, okay, yes.
And things didn't go smoothly. Here, let me tell that. Tell me that story.
I don't know if Midlothian is correct. I don't. Okay. I know that, and now it's been so long, and this is how, here's my memory is shot. And that might be correct. I could be incorrect. I think it was Chesterfield County, Manchester High School. And essentially, basically, someone who was a reader contacted me. And he worked at the high school, and he was the sponsor or the faculty advisor to their gay straight student alliance, GLSEN, Gay Lesbian Straight Alliance, GSA, Gay Straight Alliance. God. Mm-hmm. I'm really bad with acronyms. And wanted to know if I would be willing to come up there and speak to the group. And it was very small. It was something they were just getting started with. And I was enormously flattered. I mean, who wouldn't be? It's like, wow, I didn't think that I would ever be asked to speak to high school students on any level. And I said, sure, I'll do that. I'll come up there. I can come up there and do that. And are you sure it's okay? And I repeatedly asked, are you sure it's okay? Are you sure this is okay? Are you sure this is okay? And it became something else entirely. I was constantly reassured that he had spoken to the principal and everything was fine. And the principal was very supportive. I don't remember how I found out about the problem when it became the problem.
Which was?
Well, yeah, it's, I know I was out running errands and I came home and I had an email. I think it was from Jonathan Harper, who was working at the Lambda Literary Foundation at that time. And the email basically just said, do you have any comment about what's going on with your appearance in Richmond? And I was like, what are you talking about? And then the next email was actually a reporter from a newspaper in Richmond, Virginia, asking me to make a comment about the cancellation of my appearance at the high school in Richmond, Virginia. And I was like, well, this is kind of news to me. No one's told me that my appearance, that I'm not going anymore. And this was how long ago it was, is we still had dial-up internet. Mm-hmm. So if I was online, the phone line was tied up. So I didn't check messages when I got home. I just went and checked my email. And so I got offline and checked the messages, and there were at least 30 or so messages on my phone. One was from the teacher apologizing. One was from the school principal. Most of it was reporters. Almost all of it was reporters, which was really creepy to me because our number was unpublished. And I don't know how they got our phone number. But it took a few hours for me to figure out, to even know what was going on. I didn't even, because no one told me. And I did speak to the teacher, Eric. And essentially what had happened was that two of the teachers had gone to the school board to complain about me coming, being allowed on campus and being allowed to address the student body, which wasn't true. I was never going to address the student body. I was going to basically come to a club meeting for seven kids and basically sit at a desk in a circle and talk to them about being a writer. Was all it was going to be. It wasn't going to be any sex education course. It wasn't going to be anything about what it's like to be gay. It was just that come talk to them about chasing your, you know, pursuing your dreams and becoming a writer, and a kind of an inspirational thing that you can be, despite whatever society might tell you, because of who you are, you can still achieve something in this, your life, and become what you want to be. That's all it was going to be. And they had turned it into this horrific, horrific, basically that, oh, and then the religious right groups, got involved as well. It was the Concerned Women for America of Virginia, they can all go to hell, and Focus on the Family and the American Family, all those anti-gay marriage groups seized on this and basically turned it into something. It was when it was really, I had been aware of what right wing fanatic propaganda was like. I was vaguely aware of it, but I had no idea how vile, what incredible liars they were.
You didn't know how fucked up they were.
I mean, I kind of knew, but I didn't know to what extreme, just how extremely fucked up they are and what monsters they are and how they wrap themselves up. And basically, whenever, you know, I would get an email from one of those groups, you know, and I would always just respond with, "Thou shalt not bear false witness against thy neighbor. Thou shalt not bear false witness against thy neighbor." That was my mantra. "Thou shalt not bear false witness against thy neighbor." I was raised Christian. I can quote the Bible too, sweetheart. and I probably know it better than you do. So let's not go there.
Well, the ACLU became involved in this.
Yes, they did. The ACLU became involved. It was really crazy. It was really crazy. I was getting death threats.
Oh my God.
The funniest thing about the whole thing is that I had already bought the plane ticket, and I was paying my own way. They were not even paying for me to go. I was doing this on my own, and I was going to sleep on the couch, Eric's couch. And I had already bought the plane ticket, and I was like, well, you know, I bought my plane ticket to come up there in good faith at the invitation of as a representative of your school. Reimburse me for the plane ticket and we'll call it even. I'm not going to be out this plane ticket. Mm-hmm. You canceled this. You decided you approved it. Then you changed your mind. I bought the plane ticket. You just give me my money back and we'll be fine. Well, they flatly refused to pay me back, and that pissed me off. And it's like, well, I'll go, you know, that's fine, whatever. But now you're going to try to screw me out of the plane fare too? And it's like, all right, well, I'm coming. Whether you want me to or not, I'm coming anyway. And I believe the Metropolitan Community Church of Richmond offered their space to me to come give my talk at their church. Since I was not only not allowed to speak to the student group, I was banned from the campus. I was told I could not set foot on their campus. They actually brought in several ministers who showed up on their campus and did an exorcism to drive off the demons of homosexuality from the campus. No. I'm not making that up. That is totally, totally what was going on. It was insane. It was absolutely insane. And I ended up going to the MCC. It became a big deal up there. It became a much bigger deal up there than it needed to be. And I was only going to speak to like 6 or 7 kids in a small classroom situation, you know, maybe go out for coffee afterwards. And I ended up speaking to over 100 people at the Metropolitan Community Church. They recorded it, filmed it. And all. It's like, It was an unreal experience. But what I found out later, and as this continued after I went and it left and came back to New Orleans, there was a political purpose behind what they were doing to me, and I was just a tool they were using. The right wing fanatics in Virginia were using to get what they wanted politically. And what they wanted to do was to ban the gay straight alliances from They wanted legislation passed to ban gay straight alliances throughout the state of Virginia, not just in high schools, but also in colleges. They wanted to ban any kind of pro-gay, gay-positive, any queer-positive, anything like that, banned from any state school in the state of Virginia. And they used my being invited to speak to this small group as an example of what will happen, the decadent, horrible things that will happen if these are not banned and outlawed. And yeah, I wrote erotica. And yeah, I wrote gay mystery novels. Of course, all of my book covers, shirtless men. I mean, that is just how it is. And so they were like using my book covers. I was always referred to in the Richmond papers or by anything that was put out by the Focus on the Family or the Concerned Women for America as gay pornographer Greg Heron, gay pornographer Greg Heron, gay pornographer Greg Heron, gay porn writer Greg Heron. And I actually joked when I talked about this, because I actually did a couple of talks about this back in the day, is like, gay porn writer is what I want on my tombstone, gay porn writer Greg Heron. And eventually, they had a school board. It was after Katrina. This was all happened in early of 2000 and 2005, and then Katrina happened. And then while we were dealing with the aftermath of Katrina and trying to get our lives back, this was still going on in Virginia, and I kept being contacted, and we need you to come speak to the school board. We need you to come testify in the House of, their state legislature isn't a House of Representatives and a Senate like it is everywhere else. Their house is called something else. I'm going to say House of Burgesses, but I don't know if that's correct. But when that law was coming up, legislation was coming up for vote in the House of Burgesses, I was referred to as gay porn writer Greg Heron by somebody speaking in favor of the bill. So I'm forever in the congressional record of the state of Virginia as gay porn writer Greg Heron.
Well, from now on, I'm going to say, I enjoy books by gay porn writer Greg Heron.
Yeah, so it was really kind of interesting because... And in talking to reporters and seeing how they would twist, seeing how what you say, how it comes out in print and how they cherry pick what they use out of your quotation, out of your conversation to use as quotes, it was really kind of interesting to say, I didn't have a problem with them calling me gay porn writer Greg Heron because I actually had written gay porn. It wasn't an inaccurate statement, but they were using my mystery novels as examples of gay pornography. And it's like, my books don't have sex in them. They don't. My mystery novels don't have maybe, I think, in however many of them there are, there's maybe three sex scenes, and they're not graphic sex scenes at all.
Yeah.
And so... the point that I kept trying to make stupidly, I don't know why I thought I could make this point, was that they were basically saying that anything that's written about gay men by gay men is automatically pornography. This is what their point is. And that's wrong. They're basically saying that all of us are pornographers.
And that's surprising.
And that was... what I kept trying to get, point I kept trying to make, is like, yes, I have written gay pornography, but I was not, and it's really deeply offensive to me that as somebody with nieces and nephews, that their automatic default is, if I'm coming to speak to a group of teenagers, obviously I'm going to be inappropriate and talk about sexuality and sex and try to hit, you know what I mean?
Recruiting.
It's like, I'm recruiting, and it's like, well, that's not what this is about. And just the very nature that the idea that relatively successful gay professional writer coming to your school is an anathema. It's like this, there should be thunderbolts hurled from Zeus in my direction or something. It's like, why is this such a horrible thing? You would have, and ironically, the very same school, and I don't remember who it was, one of the national gay publications, I don't remember which one, Cheney's wife, Liz Cheney, had spoken at that very same high school to the entire school body, student body, several weeks before. And she published a novel in 1981 called Sisters, which has some very graphic lesbian sex scenes in it. But no one had a problem with her.
Well, lesbians are different, yes.
And so, yeah, so it was an interesting experience. Not one I would recommend.
I got to tell you, I have so many notes of things I want to go talk to you about, but I'm going to go with a fun one to me.
Okay.
And it's Queer and Loathing in America, which is your blog.
Yeah.
And I enjoy reading it.
Oh, thank you.
But here's the thing. It doesn't have a specific theme to me. Sometimes you get deep into your personal thoughts or politics and the world in general. And then other times it's just a simple rundown on your day, such as how much sleep you had or what you're watching on television. So it's like a personal journal or a diary.
Well, that's kind of what it is. And hearing it put like that makes me not, now I know why there's not, why I don't have a huge readership. And it basically began as just something for me. And I still primarily think of it as being for me. And I've always kept a diary off and on almost my entire life since I was about 7 or 8 years old. And I still have it all, which is really frightening. And I've always done that. And so in 2004, earlier in 2004, I don't want to go into detail, but went through a personal trauma in 2004, a deep, horrifying personal trauma. And it happened right like a month before my next book was due. And so Mardi Gras Mambo was due on June 1st or June or July 1st. And this happened like in Memorial Day weekend. It was a Memorial Day weekend. And they took my book off the schedule, and I was just told to take as much time as I needed, you know, take care of yourself, take care of everything, and then worry about the book when you've worked through all of this. And I literally did not write anything from Memorial Day weekend to December 26th that same year. And that's specifically why I remember the date so vividly, is because I don't know if you're familiar with, and I'm not alluding to any lack of knowledge on your part, but I have a tendency to assume everyone knows everyone. So if you don't know this person, that's fine. But at the time I have a very good friend here in New Orleans who's also a writer, Poppy Z. Bright. And Poppy Z. Bright used to keep a great blog that I read every day, and we were really good friends, and he helped a lot. I had a really great friend group who got Paul and I through that period very well. And Poppy and I had gone out for lunch about 2 weeks before Christmas, and I had told him, I said, I haven't written anything since this all started. And he was like, well, why don't you start, will you read my blog? Why don't you start a blog? And you can just write about whatever you feel like, whatever you feel. You're completely in control of it. You can write about whatever you want. I thought about it. And then on December 26th, I got up and I went onto LiveJournal and I opened my own account and I started. And it's always been pretty much, and that was what it was. It was originally meant as a tool to get me writing again. And it was also, I had not been, I had not been using my diary. I hadn't been even been writing in my diary because I always carry a blank journal around with me, and I'm always scribbling notes and writing things down and stuff in that. But I wasn't even doing that anymore. So I started the blog as a way to start writing again and to start talking about the writing process and about publishing and about my views on politics. It's like, these are all the, I can write about all the things on here that nobody will pay me to write about.
Well, I got to say, it's, even though sometimes it's just simple little things going on in your life, it's always a really good read. So I'm going to put a link to it in the show notes because I recommend it. I think it's a fun read.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. I don't really, you know, I don't, like I said, I don't really put, it's really funny because I will often like come up with like a big idea that I want to write about on my blog and then I'll start writing it and then I'll save it as a draft. And there's like 23 of those in there that I've never gone back and finished. If I don't finish it at the time, it's realistically, if I don't finish it in one shot, if I write something on my, if I write a blog entry and I don't finish it in that one shot, it's very unlikely that I'll ever go back to it. There's one I really want to finish that I've been looking at this week about what being a, about being a friend. Because I've had, over the course of my life, I've been told any number of times that I'm a terrible friend. And at one point I decided, it used to really hurt my feelings when people would say that to me, you're a terrible friend, you're such a bad friend, you're a horrible friend. And one day somebody said that to me, and I said, well, if I'm such a horrible person, why do you want to be friends with me in the first place? And this light bulb went on in my head, and it's like, I'm just going to lean into it. I'm a terrible friend. I'm going to own it. So no one can tell me that anymore. It's something I already know. It's like, I've been told enough times I'm a terrible friend. It'd be my friend at your own peril. Because I'm a horrible person. And I've been wanting to write about that. And actually, my friend Laura Lipman recently published a collection of essays called My Life is a Villainous. And her title essay, My Life is a Villainous, is about her, is this, ironically, the same thing about being a bad friend, what it's like to be a bad friend, and knowing and accepting that you're probably not the best kind of friend, the kind of friend that most people are looking for, what other people's expectations of friendship are. And I've always found that, I find that to be interesting, because in many instances, people who tell me that I'm a terrible friend usually are terrible friends. Actually, they're the ones that are terrible friends, because they, their idea of what a friend is basically, I can say anything horrible or do anything horrible I want to you, and you have to take it. Mm-hmm. But if you say anything bad or do something that I don't agree with, or that I don't want you to do, you're a terrible person. It's like, well, okay. You're right. I'm a terrible person. And interestingly enough, after I came to that realization, I've managed to get rid of those people.
Well, good for you. Good for you. Yeah, you know, before I let you go, I think we need to talk about your writing, because we haven't discussed that at all. You've written over 30 novels, and I think it's over 50 short stories.
I think that's right. I actually would have to sit down and count, and I don't really want to. Well,
I'd say your most recent, you're most known for your Scott Bradley mystery series and the Chance McCloud mysteries.
I would say that would be correct, yes.
What are the differences between the two?
I'm not sure that, to me, I know, there's a distinct difference to them. I don't think the Chance books are funny at all. The Chance books were not meant to be funny. They were meant to be very dark and very more hard-boiled, noirish type books. That's mm-hmm. how I always intended them to be. And the Scotty books are supposed to be light, fun, and funny and ridiculous. Writing the Chance books always took me into dark places emotionally, mentally. It was like, I finished working on this book for the day. I need to go have a drink and be around people and loud music or something, because I have to get out of this dark space. And the Scotty books were always a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. And the chance books I write more traditionally in that I plan them. I know what the case is. I know how he's going to solve it. I know who the killer is. I know all of that stuff. The Scotty books just, all right, this sounds like a good idea. This is where I'm going to start. And then I just kind of let it happen. I have no idea how the any of those books are going to end when I start writing them. No clue. That's why we were talking before you started recording about the blurbs. The Scotty books have always been problematic for that, in that, okay, well, this is what I think it's going to be about. Nope, it's not about that at all. Nope, not at all.
I got to tell you who you remind me of, and anybody that listens to this show probably knows he's my favorite writer, and that's Lawrence Block. And he is able to write the very dark Matt Scudder series and then the very lighthearted Burglar series. And I find it fascinating to be able to do that and that you're able to do it as well.
Well, it's really weird to me because people think the chance books have funny parts to them. And I personally don't think they do, but I'm unintentionally funny. I'm funny without meaning to be, which sounds terrible, but there's a case in point that the first time I wrote a story for a short story for a mainstream market was for New Orleans Noir, one of those Akashic Noir series books. And those are very specific, and what's required in the contributors, the stories have to be about various neighborhoods in a city, and there has to be a percentage that are minority writers, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so they picked me, the editor picked me because to do a gay story in New Orleans, and I was able to use my own neighborhood. And I wrote a story after a post-Katrina story. And I thought it was this incredibly dark, dark story. And so the book came out, and the first time we were doing readings for it, several of the other authors that were also friends of mine came up to me and said, "Oh, I loved your story so much. I laughed so hard." I was like, "What do you mean? What do you mean you laughed?" And, you know, because that wasn't the idea. You weren't supposed to laugh. And then another one, and then another one. I'm like, oh my God. And then I got up and read. And as I was reading, people laughed, but they were, and I realized it's like, well, I didn't mean for it to be funny, but it just is, because I guess the idea behind the story was basically, you have a neighbor, everybody knows somebody who's the person that bad things happen to. If something mm-hmm. bad's going to happen to somebody, it's going to happen to them. And so his tenant, who lives in the other half of the house, accidentally killed his boyfriend. And you have to help me hide the body. And how he reacts to that and how he decides to go along with it and all of that. And I guess that thought process and the reaction process was actually kind of funny. And that's kind of how I deal with stress and mm-hmm. trauma and bad news and bad things happening, is that I always revert to trying to be, to laughing about it or making jokes about it. And I guess I do that in my work too. I have my characters react. That's how they react. Nervous humor. But yeah, I actually met Lawrence Block. I love Lawrence Block. he's quite something. I love those anthologies he's been doing. Have you read the anthologies?
I haven't read any of his anthologies, no.
Well, he does these. The one that really caught my eye, and I didn't realize that he was even an anthology editor. I didn't even know that he did this. Was he had done a book of crime stories that were inspired by Edward Hopper paintings. So everyone who contributed a story had to pick a painting and then write a story inspired by the painting. And I think it's called In Sunlight and in Shadow. It's a phenomenal, phenomenal anthology. And that's how I discovered that he was actually an anthology editor as well. And he's done several others since then. And in fact, I'm going to spend some time with his most recent one today. But he's one of those writers. Like I love the burglar books. I love the burglar books, but there's so many.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
There's so many. It's like, I've also read some of the dark ones, which I also really, really, really enjoyed. But there's so many, and it's like, I don't know that I'll ever have time to read them all. But I appreciate the compliment. That's a long way around to coming to. Thank you for the very incredibly complimentary comparison.
Oh, you're very welcome. It's well deserved. And I got to at least plug your book, your latest book, which came out last year, and that's Royal Street Revillon.
Revillon, yes. Revillon.
And I don't know I'm sure you don't know Justine, who does our book recommendations. Last year, we did a show about her favorite novels in 2019, and that book was on the list.
Oh, well, thank her for me. How lovely.
I will do so. She listens to the show. She will have just heard that. So if somebody is interested in your books, do they go to the Bold Stroke Books website?
For me, financially, it's better for you if you buy the books directly from Bold Strokes, because they cut out the middleman. So when you get a percentage of the sale price, it's better to go through it. It's better for me financially if you go through Bold Strokes, but I don't care where you get them. As long as you pay for them, I don't care. Or if you check them out from the library, that's great. As long as they're not pirated, I don't care.
But they're available pretty much everywhere.
Yeah, they're available on the Bold Strokes website. You can get them on, you can get the eBooks. If you want eBooks, you can get them through Amazon or bookshop.org or Barnes & Noble or whoever your local independent can order them. I'm always supposed to plug independent bookstores, but now that there aren't really gay ones anymore, I don't kind of feel quite as obligated as I used to. Mm-hmm. But anyone can be ordered anywhere. Any site that sells books, any website, any bookstore should be able to get a copy of them. And there are quite a few of them, so choose wisely.
Well, I'll have a link to Bold Strokes in the show notes as well.
Great. Thank you.
And Greg, it has been an absolute pleasure talking with you today.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
Hit the subscribe button wherever you hear our show so you don't miss a single episode. Tell a friend too. Thank you for listening.